KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Los Van Van Live in concert at the Tao Event Center, Saturday, August 20th in Portland. Los Van Van is a Grammy Award-winning Cuban salsa group that has been a pioneer in Cuban musical fusion for the last 48 years and is one of Cuba's most popular dance bands. Again, that's Grammy Award-winning Los Van Van Live in concert at the Tao Event Center, Saturday, August 20th at 8 p.m. in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. It's 9:01. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming right up, it's Veterans Voice Radio. Marvin's flying solo this morning, and that will be interesting. At 10 o'clock, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock, Sojourner Truth looks at the tragic events in Charlottesville and asks, did the Civil War ever really end? And please remember, KBOO keeps you informed and involved. And we can always use your help. Please go to kboo.fm and click on Donate and become a member, not just a listener. That would be great. Thank you. Here comes Veterans Voice.
Well, how d'ye do, Private Willie McBride? D'ye mind if I sit here down by your graveside? And I'll rest for a while in the warm summer sun. I've been walking all day, Lord, and I'm nearly done. And I see by your gravestone you were only 19 when you joined the glorious fallen in 1916. Well, I hope you died quick and I hope you died clean. Or Willie McBride, was it slow and obscene? Did they beat the drums slowly? Did they sound the fife lowly? Did the rifles fire o'er ye as they lowered ye down? Did the bugles sing the last post in chorus? Did the pipes play the flutes or the forest? And did you leave a wife or a sweetheart behind? In some faithful heart is your memory enshrined. And though you died back in 1916, to that loyal heart are you forever 19? Or are you a stranger without even a name, forever enshrined behind some glass pane in an old photograph torn and tattered and stained and fade into yellow in a brown leather frame? Did I beat the drum slowly? Did they sound the fife lowly? Did the rifles fired o'er ye as they lowered you down. Did the bugles sing the last post in chorus? Did the pipes play the flute of the forest? Well, the sun's shining now on these green fields of France. The warm wind blows gently and the red poppies dance. The trenches have vanished long under the plough. No gas and no barbed wire, no guns firing now. But here in this graveyard, it's still no man's land. The countless white crosses in mute witness stand to man's blind indifference to his fellow man, and a whole generation who were butchered and damned. Did they beat the drum slowly? Did they sound the fife lowly? Did the rifles fire o'er ye as they lowered you down? Did the bugles sing the last post in chorus? Did the pipes play the flutes of the forest? And I can't help but wonder now, Willie McBride, do all those who lie here know why they died? Did you really believe them when they told you the cause? Did you really believe that this war would end wars? Well, the suffering, the sorrow, the glory, the shame, the killing, the dying, it was all done in vain. For Willie McBride, it all happened again, and again, and again, and again, and again. Did they beat the drum slowly? Did they sound the fife lowly? Did the rifles fire o'er ye as they lowered you down? Did the bugles sing the last post in chorus? Did the pipes play the flutes of the forest? Did the bugles sing the last post in chorus? Did the pipes play the flutes or the forest?
Welcome to Veteran Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland, 91.9 FM Hood River, and 104.3 FM in Corvallis in Albany. You can hear KBOO on the World Wide Web at kboo.fm, and you can hear our old shows, if you're interested, at kboo.fm/veteransvoice. And also on Facebook, if you put in Veterans Voice Radio Show, Angie puts up really good articles on that all the time, and she changes them, and they're very, very good, and I don't know how to do it, so Angie does it for me. And I'm Marvin, and Angie's not here today. She's in Central Oregon with a bunch of her friends to see the eclipse, and she took KBOO's fuzzy van with her, so that's pretty good. And she'll probably text me later today and tell me how it went heading over there. And and I'll see how she's doing over there. She's my pal. Today, I'm going to talk about something that I don't talk much about, and usually I've talked to my family about it. And the other day, I came to KBOO to tell Derek what the show was going to be about, and I talked to Paul Rowland about it a little bit, and I talked to Tammy about it. Tammy, our engineer, for the last 15 years, probably. I talked a little bit about it with them. And I want to start out by saying how I got to Tennessee and everything, and how I ended up in going to Greensboro. I had gone to Southern Oregon College. At the time it was college, and now it's Southern Oregon University. And I decided, I came back from Vietnam, and I worked quite a few years, and then I decided I was going to go to college. So I was a lot older than most of the students. And I finished down there, and then I decided I was going to go to graduate school. And I had a friend who had been in Vietnam with me who lived in eastern Tennessee, up in the hills and the mountains of eastern Tennessee. And we kind of kept in contact, and I told him what I wanted to do. And he says, why don't you come back here and go to the University of Tennessee? I'm going to be there, and we can share a house, and we'll go to school. And so I said, okay, I'll do that. And so I loaded up my Volkswagen bus. I headed off to Tennessee. I stopped in Albuquerque for a couple days, and I went to the university there, and I really, really liked it, and I thought about maybe going there. But I thought I'd already been accepted to UT, and my friend was waiting for me. And so I went ahead and went back to UT. And we lived in we had a house right off the campus. It was me and him and another Vietnam veteran, and we were all going to graduate school at the same time. And so it was really a fun place to be, because we were older and everything, and we didn't have to work, because I still had some GI Bill from going to undergraduate school, and they had some money, and so we didn't have to really work, and so it was kind of fun. And he was a very interesting guy. His dad was a fundamentalist preacher up in the mountains of East Tennessee. And one time he invited me up to meet his parents. And so I said, okay, I'll go. And so we drove up into Eastern Tennessee, up on the border with Virginia. And I met his mom and his dad, and they were really nice people, and we're going to stay there. And we had a really good time. And then the next day was Sunday, and he says, you want to go to see my father preach? And I said, well, I'm not very religious, but I'll go. And he said, you're going to be really surprised what you see. I said, okay. So their church was this little building. It was a very big building, and inside they had a place for the preacher to be, and there was a cross on the wall, and then there were some seats and everything, and so I sat way at the back, and my friend was sitting with me, and his father was talking and everything. He goes in there and starts preaching, and they really got riled up, dancing around and singing and everything and talking in tongues and everything. And I thought, wow, this is interesting. And then somebody brought in a box. They opened that box, and his father got snakes out. These were poisonous snakes, and he was holding them in his hands, and they were talking in tongues and dancing around and with these snakes. If I remember right, he had three snakes, two in one hand and one in the other, and they were dancing around and everything. And I thought, whoa. And so when it was finished, the father put the snakes back in and closed it down. And then he finished, and after it was over, went outside, my friend looked at me and said, what do you think? And I went, well, I've never seen anything like that. And I says, why do they have snakes? He says, because someplace in the Bible, it says that the serpents, if you're good, you won't get bitten by the snakes and all that. And I thought, wow. And I says, your father ever been bitten? He goes, yeah. His father had been bitten, and he said, my grandfather died from being bit by a snake. His grandfather was a preacher, and his grandfather had died he got bit by one of the rattlesnakes or whatever I think it was probably a rattlesnake, and his grandfather had died. And so I thought that was pretty, and I never went back up there after that. But he's still my friend. I still talk to him. And so after I graduated, and I really didn't graduate, because graduate school, you just, you know, take your classes and pay for them and everything, and you're done. And I got a job down in Nashville at this big store thing, and I didn't really like it, and I was wanting to come back to Oregon, but I needed money and everything. So I took this job down in Nashville. And when I got to Nashville, I had a little apartment and everything, and I was working, and I didn't know anybody. And I listened to the news, and Nashville was going through a really, really bad time. There was a lot of police shootings at that time in Nashville. And this was 1979, late 78, and early 79. And there was, like, every 6 weeks, the police had shot and killed somebody. And the majority of them were young black men. And it was so horrible. And there was a lot of rallies and things against the police brutality and everything. And I wanted to go and be part of it, but I hadn't really started doing that yet, until one day it just did it for me. I listened to the news, and what had happened was that the police were looking for a guy, and they were told that he was in this motel in Nashville, on the outskirts of Nashville. And they went to this, it was in the evening night, and they went to the hotel, and the desk clerk gave him the key to this guy's room. Well, they went up there, and they opened the door and rushed in, and it was the wrong room. It was a man and his wife and his children, and the children were on the bed, on the floor, and the mother and the father were in the bed, and the guy sat up, and they shot him, and it was a black family, and they shot him, and nothing happened to the police. Nothing happened to the police. And that just did it for me. I just said, that's it for me. I can't do it anymore. And the whole part about it, when these rallies started happening in Nashville, that the Klan was big. In fact, the Ku Klux Klan started in Pulaski, Tennessee in 1865. It was started by a guy named Nathaniel Bedford Forrest. He was a general in the Civil War, and he was very, very racist. In fact, he had, you know, been a seller of people, of all things. He was a people of all things, and he was the founder. And it was such a, after the Civil War, and all the Northerners, you know, the redoers down there left, the Klan really got nasty, and there was a lot of killing and a lot of lynchings and stuff by the KKK. And in fact, it got so nasty that Nathaniel Bedford Forrest quit the Klan because it was so violent. And the Klan in Tennessee at the time I was back there in the late 70s. Were very, very active. They would have cross burnings. They would march in the city. They would do all of this, you know, just out in the open. And so when I decided that I'd had enough and that I was going to go join them, I ran in and went to a rally, and I met a couple guys, Frank and I can't remember, what's the other guy's name, Frank and Danny. They were both black guys that had gone through college, one at Duke University and one at had also gone through University of Tennessee. And I got to be friends with them when we was going to the rallies. And at the rallies, they were getting bigger and bigger as time went on. And at the rallies, they were being protested by the Klan. And at this time, even back in 1978 and early 79, the Nazis were there with them. So if you threw a rock at a Klansman, it would probably bounce off him and hit a Nazi. So the Nazis and the Klan already at that time were together back in Tennessee. So that's nothing new, and it didn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise me at all with what's going on now with these guys. And so they would be there counter-protesting in the when we had our rallies against police brutality and racism. I joined a group called Concerned Citizens of Nashville against police brutality and racism. And it was very, very intense. It was very, very intense. And what's happening now, it doesn't surprise me at all what's happening now. And so what was going on is we got these, Frank and I and Danny, we got this invitation to go to Greensboro, North Carolina for a Death to the Klan rally. And we decided that we would go. And so we took off and we stopped someplace in Virginia, or not Virginia, I can't remember where we were. And we got another guy, I don't remember his name at all, and we drove to Greensboro. And we got there about 2 days before the rally was supposed to begin. And when we got there, we stayed at a house of a really nice couple in the section called Morningside Homes, which is a kind of project area in Greensboro, and mostly African-American people were there. And the rally was made up of really a lot of different people. And we were going to march through the town and go to the city hall and everything. And so the few days before that, there were a lot of meetings, and I met a lot of the organizers for the rally. And there was a group there called the Workers' Viewpoint Organization, and they were basically the people really putting it on. And they were really, these people were really educated. They were a couple of doctors and lawyers and people. And in the committee, there was also Nelson Johnson, who was a minister. He was part of it. And they were organizers for a union that were trying to organize the textile mills in that area. And so that didn't go over very well with the local Klan and the Nazis. And so at the meetings, they were talking about what we were going to do and where we were going to go and all of this. And they, a lot of speaking and a lot of stuff and sign making and everything. And they said to be really careful because the Workers' Viewpoint Organization had got into a hassle with the Ku Klux Klan and the Nazis. I think it was about a week or two before that, where they were showing The Birth of a Nation, which was a movie about the birth of the Klan and all of this stuff. It's just a horrible movie, you know. The Birth of a Nation was really horrible. And so the Workers' Viewpoint Organization and some other groups got into it with the Klan. And so the tensions were really, really high, especially when they came out with the posters saying "Death to the Klan." I kind of worried about that a little bit. And so the day of the march was November 3rd or December 3rd. It was November 3rd, 1979, and we got there. You know, we could walk from where we stand to where it was going to be. And everybody was getting ready and having a good time and laughing and everything. And all of a sudden, 10 cars come driving by full of Klansmen and Nazis. And they would drive by and holler and make noise and holler at everybody. And they drove, and then they would turn around and they'd come back. And some of the people were really, really angry. And they threw rocks, or they hit the cars with their signs, and the Nazis went, and the Klan went back by us again. And I was about, I would say, a half a block down from what's going to happen next. Me and Danny and Frank and this other guy. And so the Klan, they had 10 cars, and there was about 40 of them. So they went back up and turned back around, and they came back just almost to where we were standing, and they stopped and they got out of their cars and they opened the trunks and they got guns. They had some rifles, shotguns, some pistols. And they went back up there and they started shooting into the crowd. And some of the guys that were there had pistols too, and they shot back. And they had knives and guns. And they shot four guys and killed four guys and wounded quite a few others. And so the news media was there because we had told them, well, not me, but the organizers said that we're going to have a riot, a march, and all this stuff and everything. So there was TV cameras there. It was taking these pictures. And so when the shooting started, I don't know why, but I started running up towards where the gunfire, that half a block or so where the gunfire was coming from, and I ran up there. And by the time I got there, they had already killed those four guys and wounded the other people. And they were getting back in their cars and taking off. And so we went to help the people, the guys that were on the ground. And there was a woman, too, that was killed. And so we started helping them. And there was no police anywhere around. Not one cop. None. And they got in their cars and they took off. So we were helping the folks that were bleeding and you know the guys that had been killed. We nothing we could do for them. And someone called the ambulances and stuff. And so they took off, and everything was just crazy. And finally the cops came, and it was like, you know, to them it was nothing. It was nothing. And so the guys that were killed, I'm going to read you their names because I had met them, the few days before I was up there. And I'm going to tell you about these guys. One was Cesar Casa. He was a Cuban immigrant. He had graduated magna cum laude from Duke University and worked in the anti-war movement, and he was a union organizer in the textiles mills. And his sister, his brother, he was the brother of Anna Marie Casas, she was the president of University of Washington. And Dr. James Waller, elected as the president of the local textile workers union, originally taught at Duke University, and was a co-founder of Carolina Brown Lung Association that worked with textile workers because of that. And he had left his medical practice, Dr. Weller, had left his to be an organizer in the textile mills. And then there was William Evan Sampson. He was a graduate of Harvard Divinity School, and he would have been he was a medical student. He'd become active in the civil rights. And he worked at organizing at one of the cone mills in Greensboro textile plants. And the other, and then there was Sandra Neely Smith. She was a civil rights activist and president of the student body of Greensboro Bennett College. And she'd become a nurse and worked also as an organizer at the textile workers. And she had worked to improve the healthcare inside these textile plants. And the other was Dr. Michael Nathan. He was chief of pediatrics at Lincoln Community Health Center and a clinic for children for low-income families in Durham, North Carolina. He was wounded in the shooting, and he died 2 days later at the hospital. His wife was Dr. Mary Nathan, and she was also there. And Sandra had, when she was shot, they shot her in the head. And as I was coming up, I saw them shooting, and they were shooting people that were already been wounded, were laying on the ground, and they went up to them and shot them. And And, you know, that's pretty horrific. And they took off. And what happened was that there was federal indictment, they arrested, I think it was five or six Ku Klux Klan Nazis, and put them on trial, and they were in front of an all-white jury, and they all got off. They all got off. None of them were convicted, and they were brought back to trial again later, and again they were all got off. They got off. None of them were ever convicted of murdering these people. And then there was a trial for civil rights, that these people's civil rights were denied. And we won that one. And the city of Greensboro's police department and the Ku Klux Klan and the Nazis all had to pay a lot of money. But, you know, the only people that really paid was the police department and the Klan, I don't think, ever paid, or Nazis never paid. And come to find out, during these trials that they had, we would go back up from Tennessee. We'd go back up to see these trials and to hear these trials. And come to find out, there were two... there was an FBI informant that was in that convoy of 10 cars. There were also a paid Greensboro Police Department informant in those cars. And the police in Greensboro knew that they were coming. They knew that those guys were coming. In fact, the police department had given the informant the route of the march that it was going to happen that day. And so they knew the route that we were going to take and all of that. And the police weren't anywhere around when the gunfire started. And so later, there was a huge, huge march against racism in Greensboro at that time. And I think it was 1980. I think there was. It was just huge. And we went back up for that. And Nelson Johnson was a minister, and he had been stabbed in the arm by one of the Klansmen. And I forgot to say that one of the Klansmen did get wounded. But, you know, it turned out that he was shot by his own guys. So, you know, but Nelson had been stabbed in the arm really bad. And he was, like I said, Nelson was one of the organizers of this thing. And he was a minister. And so the city had this huge, huge rally against what had happened. And later on, the city... Years later, maybe 25 years later, I think it was, that I heard, because I was already moved back out here to Oregon, and the city of Greensboro apologized to the people who had gotten killed, and that was pretty interesting. And the funeral, we also went to the funeral, and it was a huge funeral, and they took the bodies out to a cemetery that was basically African Americans' cemetery, and the city of Greensboro paid for the funeral, and there was a lot of, you know, unhappiness about because some of the right wingers in the city didn't want the city to be involved to pay for it or anything. And the headstone, I somewhere I have it here about what was written on the headstone. It was really, really interesting. And okay, it says, on November 3rd, 1979, the criminal monopoly capitalist class murdered Jim Wehler, Cesar Casse, Mike Nathan, Bill Sampson, and Sandy Smith with government agents, Klan, and the Nazis, heroically defending the people and the five charged gunmen with the bare fist and sticks. We vowed, I can't read the rest of them, and something, and that was on their headstones, and you know, their names and everything, and then that was kind of on there. And I went back to Nashville and worked for a couple more years and still part of the coalition. And one of the big things that had happened at that time was the Klan wanted to march in a Christmas parade. They wanted to march in it was the children's Christmas parade, and the Klan wanted to march in it. And there they were in their, and the Nazis, you know, and their regalia, their hat, their robes, and all this crap. And there was a big, big, you know, discussions about it and everything. And you know, we really went after the city about it. We said, no, not after what happened in Greensboro and all this stuff. And the city relented and let them march. They marched that day, and they got away with it. They got away with it. And so that's my story about how I was involved in Greensboro, and it's called the Greensboro Massacre now. And what's happening now doesn't surprise me at all, because I saw the violence that these people do. You know, I'd seen the violence of shooting and of these black people in Nashville, and the shootings in Greensboro, and they never anything happened to them. And so what's going on now didn't surprise me at all. It didn't surprise me at all. And that's why it's really so important now that we really, really organize, that we go to these rallies against this stuff, you know. I have so much respect for those people in Charlottesville who stood up against these Nazis and these fascists and these Klansmen. And that young woman, Heather Hare, that was murdered, she was murdered by that kid in that car, that fascist Nazi in that car that ran down and hurt these people and killed that young woman, you know. And Trump, you know, he's spewing all this hate out of our White House, out of the people's house, and he's doing all this, saying all this stuff about it, you know, that there were good people on the side of the Nazis and the Klan, and there was no good people out there on the side. If you're marching with the Nazis, and if you're marching with the Klan, and you're carrying tiki torches like the Nazis did in Germany, you're not a good person. You're not a good person. And there's just no way around it. When Trump comes out and calls these people good people and all this stuff, you know, he's just feeding that hate. You know, feeding that hate. They feel now that they have a right to be out there. You know, they have a right to be out there. One more thing about Greensboro that we found out later, that what the Nazis and the Klan had a party celebrating these people being killed, and at that party, they had pictures of the autopsies of the people who had been killed that they passed around. And that's pretty disgusting. But it is so important that we continue to keep the pressure on these people, not to let them become part of the mainstream thinking, you know. We can't allow that to happen. We can't allow them to continue to do this, to do their violent marches and their carrying of the Nazi flag and the Ku Klux Klan. And to me, there's nothing alt-right about it. They are fascist. I don't call them alt-right. They are fascist, and they are brutal, because I've seen it. And so we have to continue to put pressure on what's going on. We have to go and have our senators and our congresspeople and our city people to really put pressure on the federal government about this guy in the White House that has no respect, you know, for things. When he says the things he does, that only helps these people. And we just can't afford to do that, because we're not that kind of a country. You know, we're not that kind of a country. And so, Tammy, can you go ahead and play that next song for me? This is a song that I like a lot, and I want Tammy to play it for you. Okay, thanks.
Now, when I was a young man, I carried me pack, and I lived the free life on the rover. From the Murray's green basin to the dusty outback, well, I waltzed my Matilda all over. Then in 1915, my country said, son, it's time you stop rambling, there's work to be done. So they gave me a tin hat and they gave me a gun, and they marched me away to the war. And the band played Waltzing Matilda as the ship pulled away from the quay. And amidst all the cheers, the flag waving and tears, we sailed off for Gallipoli. And how well I remember that terrible day, how our blood stained the sand and the water, and of how in that hell that they called Suvla Bay, we were butchered like lambs at the slaughter. Johnny Turkey was waiting, he'd primed himself well. He showered us with bullets and he rained us with shell. And in 5 minutes flat, he'd blown us all to hell. Nearly blew us right back to Australia. But the band played Waltzing Matilda when we stopped to bury our slain. We buried ours and the Turks buried theirs. Then we started all over again. And those that were left, well, we tried to survive in that mad world of blood, death and fire. And for 10 weary weeks I kept myself alive, though around me the corpses piled higher. Then a big Turkish shell knocked me arse overhead, and when I woke up in me hospital bed and saw what it had done, well, I wished I was dead. Never knew there was worse things than dying, for I'll go no more waltzing Matilda. All around the green bush far and free, to hum tents and pegs, a man needs both legs.
No more waltzing Matilda for me. So they gathered the crippled, the wounded, the maimed, and they shipped us back home to Australia. The legless, the armless, the blind, the insane, those proud wounded heroes of Suvla. And as our ship pulled into Circular Quay, I looked at the place where me legs used to be, and thank Christ there was nobody waiting for me. To grieve, to mourn, and to pity. But the band played Waltzing Matilda as they carried us down the gangway. But nobody cheered, they just stood and stared. Then they turned all their faces away. And so now, every April, I sit on me porch and I watch the parade pass before me. And I see my old comrades, how proudly they march, reviving old dreams of past glories. And the old men march slowly, all bones stiff and sore. They're tired old heroes from a forgotten war. And the young people ask, what are they marching for? And I ask myself the same question. But the band plays Waltzing Matilda, and the old men still answer the call. But as year follows year, more old men disappear. Someday no one will march there at all.
I want to read you a article that was written by Camilo MacBica. It says, "Don't thank me for my service. I do not want to appear disrespectful or ungrateful, but should we meet on the streets one day, do say hello or a fine day, or other such niceties, but please do not thank me for my service as a United States Marine. I make this request because my service, as you refer to it, was basically either to train to become a killer or to actually kill people and to blow things up. Now, that is not something from which a person should be proud or thanked. In fact, it is regrettable, and for me, a source of guilt and shame. Something I will have to live with for the rest of my life, as the past cannot ever be undone. So when you thank me for my service, it disturbs me a lot. First off, it brings to mind my wasted youth and lost innocence, and the horrible and unnecessary deaths of good friends and comrades. Second, it reminds me of my responsibility and culpability for the pain and suffering I have caused innocent people. Again, something I would rather forget but cannot. Third, it reinforces my belief that you have absolutely no idea about the nature and reality of the wars in Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Because if you did, you would understand that thanks are inappropriate. Fourth, it reminds me that many of those who feel the need to offer thanks were apathetic about or even supportive of the war. While they refused to participate themselves or did little or nothing to end it. And lastly, I have to admit that I doubt the sincerity of the expression of supported gratitude, as thank you for your service is just something to say, not because you care about what I did or sacrificed, but only to demonstrate your support, supposed good character or patriotism and or support for members of the military and veterans. In making this request, not to be thanked for my service, I am, of course, expressing only my opinion and perhaps my idiosyncrasy, and I make no claim to be speaking for other veterans. I would wager, however, that many, perhaps even most, who have experienced the horror of war and have the courage and presence of mind to think about and evaluate what the war they served in was truly about would understand and probably concur with this request. Those veterans, however, who may not agree, who cling to the mythology of heroism, glory, honor, and nobility of war, do so in large measure from fear that acknowledging war's reality would somehow diminish their sacrifice and the sacrifice of those whose lives were lost. Perhaps understandably, they view such sacrifices and loss as difficult enough to live with when they had value and purpose, and as intolerable if they were misguided and unnecessary. To these brothers and sisters, I would offer the following questions and observations for them to ponder. First, what was accomplished by your sacrifice and by the waste of lives and treasure in Vietnam, in Iraq, and in Afghanistan? Where is the honor, the glory, and the nobility in killing and dying for greed, incompetence, and paranoia? Second, the mythology you cling to for comfort is a tool of political leaders to make war palatable, to garner support for the militarism and abandonment of diplomacy. It is what motivates future idealistic, perhaps naive young people to heed the call to seek honor and glory by enlisting in the military to fight for a cause they have been deceived into believing is right, just, and necessary, but which is, in reality, a string of wars for corporate greed, power, and homogeny. All who are touched by war are tainted and require readjustment, perhaps even rehabilitation, but in order to truly come home from war, to make the perilous journey of healing, one must face the realities of one's own war experience, head on. As no healing is possible from fantasy, myth, rationalization, and distortion of truth. So in the future, if you really insist on thanking me for something, do not thank me for 8 years I spent as a Marine, but for the 45 or so years following my discharge from the military that I have spent as an activist fighting for human rights and social justice to end the insanity of war. Frankly, however, I would prefer that you say hello or fine day or other such nicety. You see, my activism all these years warrants no praise or merit, as it is not something I choose to do. Rather, I do it because I must. Perhaps as penance for my culpability for the sacrilege of war. And if you truly want to demonstrate your good character, patriotism, and support for the troops and veterans, rather than merely mouth meaningless expressions of gratitude for something you don't truly understand or care much about, do something meaningful and real. Do what is truly in the interest of this nation and of those victimized by war. Make demands. Demand, for example, an immediate end to the corporate takeover of our democracy and to the undue influence of the military-industrial congressional complex. Demand sanity in the Pentagon spending and a reallocation of finite resources to people focused on programs such as health care, education, and jobs rather than killing and destruction. Demand an immediate end to wars for corporate profit, greed, power, and homogeny. Demand that we adhere to the Constitution and to international law. Demand accountability for those who make war easily and care more for wealth, profit, and power than for national interest or for the welfare of their fellow human beings. And finally, demand the truth be brought home now, and that they be adequately treated and cared for when they return. So should you meet me on the street one day, do say hello or fine day. And as you talk to me about your efforts to make this country and the world a better and more peaceful place to live in, I would be happy to thank you for your service. Camilo Mac Bica. Camilo is a PhD. He's a professor of philosophy at the School of Visual Arts in New York City. He's a former Marine officer, Vietnam veteran, and longtime activist and for social justice. He has some books he's written, Worthy of Gratitude, Why Veterans May Not Want to Be Thanked for Their Service in War, and also Beyond PTSD, The Moral Casualties of War. And I thought that was pretty, would be a good thing to talk about, to read to you about what's going on, and especially now, if with what's going on, you'll see veterans in the ranks of those Ku Klux Klansers and those Nazis, and you'll see them there, and you have to wonder, you know, why they're there, why they're doing what they're doing. And the military, the Joint Chiefs of Staff came out and said that there's no place for racism. And I mean, these are the generals that run the Pentagon, the Army, the Navy, the Marines, the Air Force, and the Coast Guard. These are the top guys, and they've came out and said that that racism has no place in America or in the service. So that's very interesting when the military kind of pushes at Trump for what he's saying and what he's doing, and that is something that that, you know, that's very interesting, that there's that there's that split, that there's starting to be a bigger pushback and a split between the American people and Donald Trump for his racism and his hate, I'd say hate, that he has for many people in this country. Tonight down at 5:30 down at Salmon Street Fountain, there's going to be a rally, and my brother told me that there's a lot of people who have on Facebook who had said they're going to go. And the more and more people that we have down there, the better and better and better this is, that we have to, you know, push back. We can't stand back, because I know what these people can do. Like I told you, I've seen what they can do. And so we have to really be pushing back on this, and we can't stand back and just let it go. And we'll be back Friday, September 15th at 9 a.m. And Tammy, there it is.
Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British wars. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I've killed my share of engines in 1,000 different fights. I was there at the little big horse. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't a marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall.
On Friday, August 18th, Portland Resistance will be holding a peaceful rally and march in solidarity with the community of Charlottesville, Virginia. Friday's action is important. This situation is serious, really serious. So Friday, August 18th at 5:30 p.m. That's Friday, August 18th at 5:30 p.m. The Salmon Street Fountain by the river.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of An Evening with Dan Levinson at Kennedy Violins on Saturday, August 26th at Kennedy Violins in Vancouver. His stage show, An Evening with Dan Levinson, is an intimate evening of musical conversation that combines old-time fiddle, Appalachian banjo, stories and song in a storytelling format to tell the story of life in rural Appalachia and life on the road. Again, that's An Evening with Dan Levinson at Kennedy Violins on Saturday, August 26th at 4 p.m. at Kennedy Violins, 508 Southeast 117th Avenue in Vancouver. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Have you seen KABU's Fuzzy Boo Van? It's a giant furry blue Muppet mobile that brings music and joy wherever it's found in Portland and across the region. We're having a contest this summer. If you spot the van, post a picture on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the hashtag FuzzyBoo and you'll be entered to win a chance to have FuzzyBoo at your event, as well as other prizes. Each picture you take is another chance to win. For more info and clues on where to find the van, go to kabu.fm/fuzzyboo.
And this is KBOO Portland, where it is 10 a.m., just 7.5 hours to the Resistance event, the Solidarity Eclipse.